From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, how the FBI tracked the Unabomber. We talk with John Douglas, former head of the FBI's Serial Crime Unit. Douglas originated the FBI's Unabomber profile and co-wrote the new book, Unabomber, about the FBI's search. Also, writer and teacher Reynolds Price turns his attention to the life of Jesus as described in the Gospels. He's written a new book called Three Gospels that offers new translations of Mark and John, as well as a third gospel, Price's own version of the Jesus story. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg considers whether the internet is on the way to making English the official language of the world. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Federal inspectors are stepping up their review of ValueJet Airlines after Saturday's fatal crash of a DC-9 jetliner. All 109 people aboard were killed. Transportation Secretary Federico Peña says officials have opened an intense review of ValueJet. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
Peña says the Federal Aviation Administration will inspect everything from the use of cockpit checklists to heavy maintenance. He says the review that began in February has already led to changes by the airline. Dozens of FAA inspectors will visit ValueJet's 29-line maintenance facilities where minor repairs are done between flights and the airline's new technical support center in Atlanta and at Washington Dulles International Airport. FAA observers will also ride in the cockpit of many of the airline's planes over the next 30 days to review crew training procedures. ValueJet's president, Louis Jordan, today defended the discount airline's use of a fleet of aging DC-9s and his company's arrangement to contract for the training of young pilots hired at lower salaries. Jordan says a properly maintained 27-year-old plane is as safe as a brand-new airplane coming off the line. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
The judge in the Oklahoma City bombing trial is reviewing a new law allowing closed-circuit television coverage of the trial. Judge Richard Mache is checking the law enacted just last month. It requires closed-circuit coverage of federal trials moved more than 350 miles away so victims and survivors can follow the proceedings. Judge Mache moved the trial from Oklahoma to Denver last February because he ruled that an impartial jury could not be seated to try defendants Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols. If followed, a federal magistrate would make sure the closed-circuit feed is transmitted only to an Oklahoma City courtroom and viewed only by victims and or their survivors. Hong Kong's most senior civil servant is urging Hong Kong residents to fight to defend the basic freedoms they now enjoy or risk losing them once Hong Kong reverts to Chinese control in July of next year. NPR's Mary Kay Magstead reports.
Hong Kong's chief secretary, Anson Chan, said time is running out for Hong Kong because its attempts to explain itself patiently to Beijing haven't been enough. Chan said the Chinese government doesn't seem to understand that Hong Kong's continued prosperity depends on a continuation of its rights, freedoms, and the high degree of autonomy that China had originally promised. Chan's call for greater action from Hong Kong residents seems aimed especially at powerful pro-Beijing business people, who have thus far said it's better to cooperate with Beijing than to make waves. But other Hong Kong residents have grown increasingly concerned in recent weeks, as Beijing has made it clear that it will replace Hong Kong's elected legislature with an appointed one, and that it will not tolerate open dissent. I'm Mary Kay Magstead in Hong Kong.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up 11.5 points at 5,529. Trading is active. This is NPR. The United Nations has scaled back its plans to return home nearly 1 million war refugees. The world body's refugee agency says continuing ethnic hatred has forced their decision. Tension, especially between Serbs and allied Muslims and Croats, has prevented many people from returning home. Freedom of movement, a fundamental part of the peace agreement, is far from certain. Refugee officials from all sides in the conflict have agreed to a set of UN guidelines promoting confidence-building visits by minorities to their original towns. Two Israelis were hurt in a drive-by shooting today in the West Bank. Israeli security officials believe extremist Palestinians are responsible. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
It was the first attack on Israelis since four suicide bombings killed almost 60 people in February and March. Israel Radio reported that occupants of a car originally shot at an Israeli bus but caused no injuries. They then shot at Israelis waiting at a hitchhiking post near the Jewish settlement of Beit El, north of Jerusalem. Two Israelis were injured by the shooting, one seriously. Witnesses said the driver then continued toward a nearby Palestinian refugee camp where the car was abandoned. The shooting comes just 16 days before Israel's national elections, in which one of the main issues is the question of personal security. Israeli analysts say a large-scale terrorist attack could cause Israeli Prime Minister Shimon Peres to lose the election. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Prodigy Services Company has new owners. The troubled online service was sold yesterday by IBM and Sears to International Wireless Incorporated and a group of Prodigy executives, including Prodigy's president and CEO. The new owners hope to shed Prodigy's ailing image and make it competitive again with its rivals CompuServe and America Online. Published reports indicate the deal was worth $250 million, far less than the $1 billion IBM and Sears had invested in it. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The search for the Unabomber was the most expensive manhunt in American history. My guest, John Douglas, is the former head of the FBI's Serial Crime Unit. He participated in the Unabomber search and drew up a psychological profile of the Unabomber based on the available evidence. He's the co-author of the new book, Unabomber, and co-author of the bestseller Mindhunter, about his work tracking serial killers. You may be thinking that the FBI can't take much credit for finding the alleged Unabomber, Theodore Kaczynski. After all, the FBI found him only because he was identified by his brother. But Douglas says this was part of the FBI strategy. The FBI urged the New York Times and Washington Post to publish the Unabomber's manifesto in the hopes that a friend or family member would recognize the Unabomber from his writing, as Kaczynski's brother did. As it turned out, Theodore Kaczynski's name was already in the FBI Unabomber databank. I asked Douglas why it took so long for the FBI to identify him as the alleged Unabomber.
He was in the data bank, but it was just there were thousands of names in there. And what you would do is you put the names of professors at the various universities where the bombs took place. You put the names of students in the engineering departments and the mathematics departments. And so he was in the data bank, but that doesn't necessarily mean we would get to him, sooner or later, because still there was this mindset. There was this mindset in the FBI in certain places that we were not looking for a college-educated, bright, white male individual. That we were in fact looking for a blue-collar airline mechanic type of individual. And I have to say that was the mindset right up to the day. In some cases, the day Kaczynski was arrested.
Well, why did you you thought it was going to be a highly educated person with academic connections, right?
Right.
So what led other people in the FBI to think that this was going to be an airline mechanic?
Because one of the devices was made in such a way that the components of the bomb told these so-called experts that the only person who would have access to these different parts of the bomb would be someone who worked in the airlines, particularly an airline mechanic. But when you look at and this is before the manifesto, when you see the bombs and how they're made and how the person has to have a background in physics, in chemistry, in mathematics, and he has to be extremely bright to be able to make these bombs, because if he isn't, these bombs are going to explode in your face, just like we lose many potential bombers every year because they just don't have the intelligence, they don't have the personality where they can sit down at their workshop and spend hundreds of hours meticulously putting the different bomb parts together. So there was a kind of a tug of war going on as far as, you know, which is it, a college educated or is it a blue collar? But once the manifesto, even then, when that was published and we saw the writings, the group of us in the behavioral science side, the ones that were still in the bureau, those of us who now were retired, I mean, there's no way that this is going to be a blue collar type of subject.
Let's hear your psycholinguistic analysis of the Unabomber manifesto. What are some of the key parts in the content and language?
One of the things that rang true, and what I told people when you do an analysis like this, you don't hold the document 3 inches from your nose. You hold a document like that 3 feet from your nose. And therefore, don't try to figure out every little nuance. For example, the initials FC, which he says stood for the Freedom Club. I mean, who knows? Early on, we had the initials FC etched in those bombs. I mean, people took hours, days, hundreds of hours trying to figure it out. Who knows what it means? It really doesn't mean anything. I remember interviewing David Berkowitz, the son of Sam, and on the bottom of his letters that he wrote to Detective Joe Borelli, the New York City Police Department, when he was terrorizing New York City, he had this little logo down there, and they brought in these psychologists, and he said, oh, look at the loops of these logos. It looks like the breast of a woman, and that's the problem that he has. He has this latent hostility. Well, when I interviewed Berkowitz at Attica Penitentiary, I said, hey, David, I said, what about this logo down here? What does this mean? He says, well, it looks good. It looks pretty good. I said, that's it? It doesn't mean any deep significance? So when you get back to the manifesto, one of the things that you do is you skip over the ideology. You skip over that. And what the pattern is are words like inferiority, low self-esteem. There's words of depression and inadequacies, inferiority, and that kind of rings true throughout that whole document. And what you're dealing with is a paranoid individual, and typically paranoid individuals, what they do is they project their blame, like he was doing, projecting the blame onto society and into technology. He was really describing himself, this inadequate nobody, who for the first time has become a somebody. In fact, there was a time after the Oklahoma City bombings, if you recall, 5 days later, we had another bomb from the Unabomber. He believed, is my opinion, that he was upstaged by this inadequate nobody was upstaged by someone who made a bigger, more powerful bomb. So he just wanted to show us that, hey, I'm back in business.
You talk about the recurring theme of inferiority, lack of self-esteem, and he addresses that directly in the manifesto. There's a little chapter called Feelings of Inferiority. He writes, he's actually referring to the psychology of modern leftism. Can you explain that, what he's talking about there?
Well, what he's trying to do is he's trying to convince us that it's these other people, the people from the technology types of people, the people involved in genetics. These are the people that in their profession are the ones that have this low self-esteem. They're inferior, and they're the ones who are controlling a society for us. We have no say. We're bringing up children, pushing them into mathematics, pushing them to the sciences, and basically programming them to be something that they really don't want to be. And that theme runs throughout that manifesto as well. And when you start looking now in retrospect into the background of this individual, it appears this is the way he was as a young kid growing up, educated by two parents, not educated, but very interested in having the children educated, and would read very scientific books to them, were very strong, pushing them academically. And it appears that he went to Harvard, graduated in 2 years, went on to school, and he has this animosity. He's the one who has these feelings of inferiority. Here he is in college, 19 years of age. He never had a date. Even when he graduated from high school, he graduated after 2 years in high school. Never was with his peers, never socialized. And really, one of the things I found with violent offenders, period, is they have some type of physical handicap or disability. I remember doing a case in California. The subject was a serial murderer, rapist, and he had a speech impediment. And another individual I had as a child developed polio, and he received the wrong vaccine. He had this hatred, this anger for people. That pushed him forward into becoming a violent offender. This individual, his handicap could have very well has been his high IQ. His IQ is between 160 and 170. When his father's friend, who was a psychologist, tested him when he was only 5 or 6 years of age, and because of that high IQ, it just kind of made him the odd man out, and he just did not fit in with anyone. So my point is, when you read any readings from a person like this, they are projecting feelings to someone else, what these other people like, but really they're describing themselves.
What type of personality writes manifestos when they're committing crimes?
Okay, the type of person that writes, first of all, is telling us that he feels much more comfortable using this form of communication. So people like this are not the type of people you get to see standing up on a soapbox on a campus ranting and raving about some social issue. This person expresses himself by writing letters to newspapers, by writing letters to his congressmen, congresswomen, and therefore, from an investigator, when you finally come up with a suspect, you will in fact find copies of the original manifestos. You'll find diaries and digest, which will set forth his plan, the plan that he had for years and years of what he really wanted to do in society. In his case, was to make bombs and hurt people.
Is the manifesto type of bomber such the loner that the manifesto, the communique, is one of the rare forms of communication he has with the outside world?
Right. The communique is the only way that these people will communicate. But then what happens is they generally start off writing communiques to the newspapers signing their real names. But as they get older, they get worse. And as they get into their late 30s and 40s and they feel like no one is paying attention to them, and that's when you begin to see some triggering mechanism that now they say, it's not worth it anymore. I'm going to get the recognition. I'm going to get the attention that I'm looking for here. And I'm going to start committing some crimes. In his case, it was a bomber. I see the same things with certain arsonists, certain rapists, and certain other forms of murderers.
My guest is John Douglas. He's a retired FBI expert on criminal personality profiling. He worked on the Unabomber investigation and has written a new book called Unabomber. Let's take a short break, and then I'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with retired FBI agent John Douglas, who's just written a new book called Unabomber. What were the first questions you asked when you joined the Unabomber investigation?
What I wanted to know was with what is going on within the city of Chicago, because I knew that the subject had to be from the Chicago area, which was really a thorny issue years later when the investigation left the Chicago area, because I always believed you better stay in that Chicago area because that's where you're going to catch them. So I wanted to find out what's going on politically, socially in the city, and there really wasn't too much there as far as information that could have caused him to send these bombs. Plus, you know, why these victims? So you do a background of each of the victims, and you really couldn't find any kind of a thread of anything mutual about them that would link these victims together. You had airline people and you had university professors. So I said, Tom, I said this appears to be a crime with no apparent motive. And when you have a crime that where there's no apparent motive, we have to look proactively. And a person who sends bombs like this generally follows up his victims. So, you know, he may inject himself into the investigation. And I began suggesting some proactive techniques, but really most of it fell on deaf ears.
What were you suggesting?
I just wanted, even then, was to release information relative to pre-offense behavior patterns. You know, where did this person come from? He didn't come from out of space. What was he like as a kid growing up? What was he like leading up to these bombs? He had to be making bombs. He had to be experimenting with these devices. There has to be complaints filed against him. So let's release that, and let's release post-offense behavior patterns, which I believe someone would recognize those patterns as well, as someone who's extremely obsessed with the investigation, who is following the press, and he's clipping out newspaper clippings. And those are kind of the things I was suggesting to the task force, but there wasn't much done.
You say in criminal personality profiling that the earliest crimes are usually the most telling. Why is that, and does that apply to the Unabomber?
Right. when you look at a series of cases, and it's important to understand which really is the first case. Are we getting all the cases of the Unabomber, of the rapist, of the murderer, whatever? The first case tells all, because the first case, the nature of the beast, the nature of the offender is to perpetrate a crime in an area where he feels the most comfortable. And those are generally areas where he lives or where he's is employed. Later on, he'll branch out of that common area and go off to other areas in the city or in the United States. But he has a tendency to come back and gravitate back to that area. And that's where you're going to catch him, because that's where, you know, he's just starting out. He's going to have some flaws in his modus operandi until he begins to perfect it. And that's when you should be much more public with information, because people will recognize the traits and characteristics and patterns that you're giving them. Years later, it's just going to be a very, you know, faint memory of what took place, say, 18 years earlier.
Now, you mentioned earlier that you thought one of the dead ends that the FBI pursued was looking for somebody who was an airline mechanic. They thought the Unabomber was going to be an airline mechanic. What are other dead ends that you think the FBI pursued in the really long Unabomber investigation?
One of the bombs had there was a note in one of the bombs, and through indented writing, that means that it appeared that the Unabomber wrote on a piece of paper, and there was this faint impression, and it was the name Nathan R., Wednesday, 7 a.m. And so the FBI looked, and it was a lead we had to do, but we went through over 20,000 different Nathan R.'s looking for the Nathan R., but really what should have been done, and we knew this, and behavioralists knew this, is that we were looking here at someone who was staging the scene. This person had too much intellect to make a mistake like that. I mean, here's an individual, after he makes his bombs, he tells us in his writings, he would wipe down the bombs with oil to obliterate any possibility of obtaining any fingerprints off of them. So he threw us really a red herring. And so that was, that took, I don't know how many thousands of investigative man hours to come up with no information.
Was the Unabomber a particularly difficult case for any reason? I mean, what made it such a difficult case?
I don't think it really does not have to be a difficult case. You know, sure, 1980, my unit was just getting going and the type of work I was doing. But certainly by 1985, I and others began to have the very good reputation. And if they'd only would listen to us and balance what we're saying. We saw the same problem in Waco, Texas. And as you know, after the Waco fiasco out there, there was a total reorganization within the FBI so that the behavioral guys like myself and my people were going to have an equal voice in the decision-making process. We never had an equal voice. We're sitting outside the door, you know, and waiting for our turn to give our piece of information. But you're dealing in bureaucracy. You're dealing in an agency that was pretty much in the 1980s, pretty much ex-military guys, and strictly they see black and whites. They don't see any shades of gray, and it's like the Ephraim Zimbalist or the Joe Friday, just the facts, ma'am. And when you get a guy who's behavioral science, they look at us as, oh, these touchy-feely guys. You know, what do they know? But we know a hell of a lot, and we've had a tremendous success rate over the years. They just have to listen to us and once in a while.
Have you spoken with Kaczynski, the alleged Unabomber?
No, I haven't, but he would be an excellent one to, you know, to interview. These type of people would be very difficult to interview because what you'll find is that they have difficulty looking at you in the eye. He would prefer, and I know this, he would prefer expressing himself in the written form of communication. So for him to sit down across the table from me and to talk to me, it'll be very difficult. So I would give him a piece of paper and have him write out his feelings and his thoughts, and I would probably try to avoid eye contact with him because they get really antsy when you look at him straight in the eye.
Would you try to play up to his ego? Would you try to flatter him?
Usually assassin types and these types of murderers, the ones that I interviewed, they don't like that. You think they would, but they don't like that.
They can see through it?
Yeah, they can see through that. The typical kind of a killer, serial killer, rapist, you know, they're angry as people, and I'm not saying that he's not angry, but you can do that with them. But these particular types, they can see right, you know, right through that. He's a very depressed individual, and I know they have a suicide watch on him, which I think is very, very good, because I will be very surprised if he does not attempt to take his life.
Why?
Because a person like this needs control. He wants control. He was in control. He was isolated. He was off by himself. And now what have we done? Now we've put him in a cell, and of course everyone says he's doing well. He's shooting baskets. He's doing some push-ups. He's eating 3 square meals a day. But you better not turn your head too long, and because he'll study the patterns of the security when they're not watching him 24 hours a day, every minute of the day. And a person like this, I would suspect, would attempt to take his life. I cannot imagine or visualize him going to court and standing up and ranting and raving. This has not been his personality.
What is the thing you'd most like to know now about Kaczynski?
I would really like to know specifically the precipitating factor or event that really, you know, triggered him. Generally, it has to do with interpersonal relations, what I found in the past, and I just want to see if that was true with him, that caused him to send and create that first bomb. I know he was in a somewhat of a relationship there, but that relationship terminated. And I know he was having problems, difficulties at home in Chicago with the family, but there had to be something that really precipitated that. I'd also want to know if he injected himself into the investigation for future cases, because I have seen that in the past where people will maybe hang around the investigation, provide bogus information. I'd like to know if he did in fact follow the cases very closely. Did he stick around town after the bombings? Did he go to the public libraries? And I guess we'll know that, whether or not he kept a scrapbook. I suspect that he would, in fact, kept a scrapbook of all the different bombings. But, yeah, those would be a few of the things I'd like to know.
John Douglas, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
John Douglas is co-author of the new book, Unabomber. He's the former director of the FBI's Serial Crime Unit. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, a new look at the Gospels. We talk with novelist and English professor Reynolds Price about his new book, Three Gospels. And Jeffrey Nunberg considers the dominance of English on the Internet. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The stories in the Old and New Testaments always had a hold on writer Reynolds Price. Even before he could read, he was captivated by illustrated Bible stories. As an English professor at Duke University, he's taught seminars on the Gospels. Price is an acclaimed novelist and author of the memoir A Whole New Life, about the impact of spinal cancer on his physical and spiritual life. His new book, Three Gospels, includes his new translations of Mark and John. Price has spent 20 years studying the ancient Greek, which the Gospels were first written in. The third Gospel in his book is his own retelling of the story of Jesus. He told me why the story of Jesus fascinated him as a child.
I do remember at the age of about 5 or 6, really being, before I could begin to read myself, being fascinated by the pictures of Jesus. And I suppose that along with the story of the boy Samuel in the Old Testament or the young boy David in the Old Testament, Jesus is one of the few children in the Bible who has a starring role. And maybe that was the initial interest. I was aware that my parents went to certain kinds of churches. They belonged to different churches. Mother was a Methodist, father was a Baptist, and occasionally I went with them and I saw other pictures of this child or this child after he'd grown up. And that's presently the way I remember the start of my fascination with the New Testament. That may not be true, but it's what stays with me still.
Do you think of the Gospels as fascinating fiction or as truthful accounts?
I think of them as truthful accounts, however, accounts that were not written by people who observed what we think of as the normal standards of reliable biography or history. I would say that in general, the itinerary and the character of Jesus, as described in the Gospel of Mark, which seems to be the oldest of our Gospels, that seems to be a perfectly credible itinerary and credible behavior for a human life, and a human life of a very extraordinary sort, no doubt, but nonetheless one that, to me, presents no insuperable odds to belief and trust in it.
What about the resurrection? Does that present any difficulty in believing?
Well, it presents terrific difficulties in knowing what actually happened. It seems to me fairly beyond question that something extraordinary happened, apparently some 30-odd hours after this man was dead on the cross, was hastily placed into the tomb so that the Sabbath would not be desecrated by his remaining unburied. And the women of his group, some women from his group, come back on the Sunday morning, and they find the tomb empty, and shortly thereafter, what appears to be him, makes appearances, first to the women, and then to other members of that early community of disciples. It's interesting, one of the most interesting things in all the resurrection stories, a number of which are rather contradictory of one another in terms of where they occurred and when they occurred, one of the fascinating things is that in almost all those appearances, when he first appears, they don't seem to know who he is. There does seem to be some kind of alteration in his experience. So I certainly can't tell you or anyone in the world what occurred. Was a ghost up and walking around? Was a live man? Was a dead man resuscitated and was up walking around? I really don't know. I think something very extraordinary happened that was not fraud, and that these terrified men and this small little band of brave but threatened women were convinced that someone that they had put in the tomb dead on Friday was up and walking around on Sunday morning.
Why did you choose the Gospels of Mark and John to do new translations of?
Well, first of all, I think because for me they're the most interesting as works of literature. They're the most wonderful stories. Mark just moves like a shot out of a gun, very rapidly. He's much the shortest of the Gospels. John is the next shortest after Mark, and has its own tremendous odor for me and for a great many other scholars even today. It has the odor of eyewitness about it, even more direct eyewitness than the witness of Peter, which is preserved in Mark. So they're the two most original of the Gospels for me. They're the two prime Gospels. Matthew and Luke, it seems virtually certain, are closely based, even verbally closely based, on Mark. John is this strange, independent story. He very well, whoever wrote John, man, woman, child, may very well not have known the other three Gospels at all.
Now, why did you want to do new translations?
Because I really wanted to know what the Greek said, as opposed to what some modern translator or ancient translator may want me to believe it said. And as I began to study the Koine Greek 20-odd years ago, the common demotic street Greek in which these little short books are written, I began to realize that virtually all modern translations, all translations from, let's say, the latter half of the 20th century, are far more nearly paraphrases than they are translations. They're attempts by a scholar or generally a committee of scholars to say, this is what we really think, perhaps in parentheses, hope it means. My desire was really to get back as closely as I can to the minimal English nouns and verbs which would most accurately, so far as I could tell from scholarship, which would most accurately reflect what the Greek words are on the Greek page.
Now, you don't use the word sin in your translations. Why not?
I don't use the word sin because it's not because I don't believe in sin and believe that Jesus was against it, but because I think in Orthodox Christianity, in Christian churches, the word from very early on has been such a loaded and condemnatory word. The first thing that we see about Jesus and see throughout his ministry in all the Gospels is he was phenomenally open to all kinds of human beings, whether they were tax collectors, prostitutes, adulterous creatures, people covered with loathsome diseases which made them ritually impure. He was welcoming. He was open-armed. He went to dinner with them. There is no evidence in the Gospels that he asked them even to repent their ways. Very few instances in which that seems to happen. So the word sin just seems to me very connected with evangelical, condemnatory forms of Christianity and some other religions. The Greek word reflects the meaning of the Hebrew word, which really is a missing of the mark, an arrow which misses its target. You try something and it fails. So it did seem to me that wrong was a more useful word to translate that word, sin, which is normally translated sin. So throughout my translations of Mark and John, the word wrong prevails.
Can you think of a sentence in which the King James would use the word sin and you've changed that to wrong?
I think it's very early in Mark when he first comes back after his 40 days and nights in the desert. It's not an actual use of the word sin, but it's a use of a word which is generally translated as repent, and I translate it by its more literal Greek word, which is to turn, to stop and rotate, look another way. He comes back after John the Baptist has been handed over to Herod, and he comes back into Galilee, his home county, declaring God's good news and saying, and this is the mark, the time has ripened and the reign of God has approached. Turn and trust the good news instead of repent. The word has the implications of repentance, of begging for forgiveness, but it doesn't have that quality of the condemnatory a preacher who feels a moral superiority towards his audience.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Reynolds Price. He's a novelist, also an English professor at Duke University, and his new book is called Three Gospels. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with writer and English professor Reynolds Price. His new book is called Three Gospels. I'd like you to read the end of your translation of Mark.
All right.
Maybe just kind of bring us up to this moment. Set it up for us.
Okay. Here's the very ending of my own translation of the ending of Mark. And it's important to say for people who may be a bit startled when I finish that the oldest manuscripts which we possess of Mark do not contain the final verses which described the resurrection appearances of Jesus. Those verses were written by someone else, not Mark. We don't know whether Mark intended to end at the point where I stop or not. It's a very abrupt ending. But in fact, he either intended that we stop there or the last page or the last few lines of his manuscript disappeared while there was only one copy. The women have gone to the tomb on the Sunday morning to anoint the dead body of Jesus, which they were unable to anoint on late Friday because of the coming on of the Sabbath. When the Sabbath passed, Mary the Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome bought spices so they could come and anoint him. Very early on the first day of the week, they came to the tomb as the sun was rising. They said to each other, "Who rolled the stone off the tomb door for us?" And looking up, they saw that the stone had been rolled back, for it was huge. Entering the tomb, they saw a young man sitting on the right, dressed in a white robe, and they were much stunned. But he said to them, "Don't be stunned. Are you looking for Jesus the crucified Nazarene? He was raised. He isn't here. Look, the place where they laid him. But go tell his disciples and Peter. He's going ahead of you to Galilee. There you'll see him as he told you." Going out, they fled the tomb. They were shuddering and wild, and they told no one nothing, for they were afraid.
Assuming that is the way Mark intended to end it, it's such an interesting end. It almost reminds me of a certain type of elliptical short story.
I think it's the way Mark intended to end it, yeah. I mean, I think more and more in the 20th century, scholars, New Testament scholars who doubt virtually everything in the world, what the one may say about a gospel, more and more scholars have begun to believe that that was Mark's intended ending. The end of the story, thereby demanding from the reader a decision, really a commitment of faith, just as the women are suddenly having to decide what to believe about this extraordinary empty tomb. The reader, him or herself, is having to believe, "My God, what's happened?"
But it ends with the women who discovered the empty tomb being stunned.
Being stunned.
And not even feeling comfortable passing this on to anybody else.
It even ends with the word "for." The Greek ends, ephobuntogar. They were phobic. They were terrified, for they were afraid. And we don't know. As far as we can, if Mark were all we had, we wouldn't know that the women went back and told the disciples that the tomb was empty. Matthew says, for instance, that as they were fleeing the tomb, the risen Jesus actually encountered them. John says that the first of them to whom the risen Jesus spoke was Mary Magdalene herself. After Peter and John had come and looked into the tomb and found it empty and gone away, the Magdalene who went there first is still standing there. And this rather mysterious man comes up to her, and she thinks it's the gardener because the tomb is set in a garden outside the city walls. And she says, "Sir, if you've taken my Lord and moved him, tell me where you've put him." And the gardener, believed to be gardener, says, "Mary." And that's when she recognizes and says, "Rabboni, my teacher," in Aramaic. Extraordinary moment in world literature and in world history, since it becomes the essential beginning of this sect of Jesus followers who, within another little more than 200 years, have essentially taken over the Mediterranean basin and the Roman Empire.
You said that when you were growing up, your mother was Methodist, your father was Baptist.
Right.
And I wonder if that gave you a certain distance on religion, a certain overview, knowing that there were two religions in your house that were respected. So it couldn't be an all or nothing at all thing.
Yeah, I mean, I was aware that both those religions had very core similarities. But my parents, as loving as they were, and I think they were as good a marriage as I ever watched, they both insisted on remaining in the denominations, the congregations in which they'd begun as children, Methodist and Baptist. And in the small town South, 50, 60 years ago, Those are matters of considerable intellectual and emotional distinction. So I think maybe you're right. I never thought of it that way. I did try very early to find another kind of church of my own. I tried to go to the Episcopal Church. In fact, I was baptized in the Episcopal Church. But then as my life went on, I simply found myself withdrawing from institutional religion altogether. And I'm not proud of that, but it is a fact of my life.
Why did you withdraw from institutional religion?
Well, I think of it, looking back, when I realized when that occurred, which was when I was in my early 20s, I think it was largely fueled in me by my disgust at the appalling hypocrisy of Southern white churches when the whole matter of racial integration became a live issue in the South and in the rest of the country.
You got spinal cancer a few years ago, and that has left you unable to walk. Did that test or deepen your faith?
Oh, I think it deepened it and informed it in all sorts of ways. But I had never had I can't remember really a serious time in my life, a serious period in my life in which I wasn't convinced that the universe we live in is created by a benign force that we can call the Creator or God. And that force seems to me to have concentrated itself at one particular period into the life of a man called Jesus. So I didn't have a lot of shaky religious doubts to prop up at the time of my illness, but certainly going through spinal cancer was an ordeal that strengthened any beliefs that I had.
But when you're suffering, I mean, it can cause you to really challenge any belief that you have in God at the same time as it could deepen it. But I think it can lead to despair rather than more faith.
It can lead rapidly to despair. Maybe the fact that I was Southern and had really grown up. After all, I was born only about 60-odd years after the end of the Civil War, and as a child I knew people who remembered the Civil War. My father's mother had known General Robert E. Lee, met Robert E. Lee when she was a little girl. So we were the only white folks in America who ever defeated in their homes, on their own home ground. And I think one of the things that perhaps gave me was this sense of fatalism. Why not? Instead, I wrote a book about my own cancer ordeal a couple of years ago, and one of the things I say in it is very true, and that was that the question that I hear so many Americans ask in the face of calamity is, why me?
Right.
But that never occurred to me, frankly. My answer to that would have been, why not me? It happens to everybody sooner or later, unless we all die in our sleep at the age of 112. No, it didn't seem to me. That wasn't what worried me and baffled me. I was afraid to die. I didn't want to die at the age of 51, which is when it occurred in my life. But I was perfectly aware that it was a fate that sooner or later would overtake me. My own father, after all, whom I adored, died when I was 21, and he was 54 years old.
There's a bestseller whose title asks the question, why do bad things happen to good people? What do you think of that question?
Well, I think it's an interesting question, and perhaps the most interesting question of all. And someone did send me that book at the time that I was very ill, and I remember reading it. I suppose one of the ways to consider what you're asking is really to ask me where I think evil and suffering and pain come from. I see nowhere else to discover the origins of evil than to look at that great Hebrew poem, the Book of Job, which we have in the Old Testament. And at the end of Job, Job finally just says, God, tell me why you have afflicted me in the way that you have, with all these diseases and with the loss of my children and my livestock, etc. And God just says, if you didn't make the universe, sit down and shut up. I'm not going to answer you further than that. I'm inclined to believe that whatever the Creator is, whatever the creative power is, that everything which exists, good, evil, pain, joy, flow from that single source. Certainly Hinduism has always believed that. God is all things and has all manifestations. A child's beautiful, soft skin and the AIDS virus.
And what did you find in the Gospels that particularly spoke to you when you were sick?
What I found in the Gospels then is something that I think virtually everyone finds who reads them, and that is the realization that first and foremost, in his own career, Jesus was known as a healer. There seems no question that he had some sort of unspecified powers to make certain kinds of human beings feel that he had healed them of some very real psychic or physical ailment. And I was looking to be healed at that time. And I do point out that 12 years later, I'm still alive when I wasn't supposed to be. I knock on wood, of course, as I say that.
So you found that even just reading the story and thinking about it had a healing effect?
I think it did. Absolutely did.
Reynolds Price, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Reynolds Price's new book is called Three Gospels. He's an English professor at Duke University. This is Fresh Air. The dominant language on the internet is English. The editor of a magazine called The Futurist predicts that thanks to the internet, English will become the native language in much of the world by the next century. Linguist Jeff Nunberg, a regular user of the net, has his doubts.
In 1898, when Otto von Bismarck was an old man, a journalist asked him what he thought was the decisive factor in modern history. He answered without skipping a beat, the fact that the North Americans speak English. You wonder what he would have said if they'd had a net account at the Reichschancellery. Everybody seems certain that cyberspace is going to be an English lake, and some people think it will wind up inundating everything else in the world in the process. The Sunday Times ran a story a couple of weeks ago with the headline, World Wide Web, Three English Words. One computer writer described the internet as a great force for the Anglification of the planet. And indeed, one linguist has suggested that the UN should simply declare English the world language, but rename it Globalese, so as not to imply that it belongs to any one community anymore. Frankly, though, I have my doubts as to whether Bismarck would have been completely reassured by this maneuver. Certainly, there's no shortage of people who view the prospect of a monolingual English net with some alarm. One Russian described the web as the ultimate act of intellectual colonialism. And French President Jacques Chirac was even more apocalyptic. He described English domination of the internet as a major risk for humanity. Is any of it warranted, the neocolonialist swaggering on one side, the hysteria on the other? There's no question that English is overwhelmingly dominant on the net right now, but a lot of that is due to accidental factors. The internet was an American development, after all, and something between 70 and 90% of its present users are from the English-speaking countries. But the proportion of native English speakers on the internet is dropping very rapidly, particularly as net service providers and search services proliferate in other countries, and as people overcome the difficulties of sending and receiving accented characters and non-Roman alphabets. It's a safe bet that we English speakers will be in the minority well before the end of the century. Even then, of course, there's no question that English will still be the principal lingua franca for internet communication, just as it already is for most international science, business, and tourism. But that's mostly old news. What makes the net different from most of the communications technologies that preceded it is how much it does to preserve linguistic distinctions. The telegraph, the telephone, the radio all made the world smaller. Now, finally, we have a technology that helps to keep the world a big and more interesting place. One reason for this is that languages aren't really in competition on the net the way they are in print or other media. A Danish rock festival can post its web page in English and German for the benefit of foreigners, but it also posts a version in Danish so that the locals don't feel slighted. And for that matter, the National Library of Wales can post its web pages in English and Welsh. In fact, you could argue that the languages that have the most to gain here are the ones that are too small or scattered to support a lot of the traditional print media, languages like Welsh and Yiddish and Esperanto. But every language group is taking advantage of this. In a half hour's wandering around the net the other day, I found discussion groups conducted in more than 60 languages, at which point I stopped counting. The Italians were talking about the elections, as they always do. The French were exchanging risque stories. The Indonesians, as best I could tell, were arguing over whether the movie True Lies was anti-Islam or merely stupid. All of which confirms the lesson we've already learned from the proliferation of discussion groups on domestic internet services. If you give people the chance, they're less interested in turning the net into a world forum than a backyard fence. There's a new Tower of Babel, and it has an Intel sticker on the side.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Palo Alto Research Center. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our program is directed this week by Alan Tu. I'm Terry Gross. Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, writer Mary Gordon. Her father died when she was 7. She's always said that's the most important thing you could know about her. But her sense of her own identity changed when she uncovered the lies her father had built his identity on. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.